Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Dr. Philip Frost would like to bring the scientific search for extraterrestrials to his namesake science museum in downtown Miami. He also would like the museum's work to highlight the science of climate science, but not what he considers, quote, the political debate, end quote, over the human contribution to climate change.
If it's real, it can be dealt with in a lot of interesting ways.
Science has made Frost a billionaire three times over, running three different pharmaceutical companies. We'll talk more about that later on in this program. He has given millions of dollars to further scientific education through funding scholarships for Florida students to study science, technology, engineering, and math at Oxford, money to create the University of Miami's Frost Institutes for Science and Engineering, and the seed money for the new science museum in Miami that bears his and his wife's name. Frost is not a climate change denier, but it is the human contribution to climate change that he's clearly skeptical about.
I don't question that it's changing, but what I also know for an absolute fact is that over the centuries and over the thousands of years, it's been changing all the time, going in both directions. We had the Ice Age here 10,000 years ago, which wasn't so long ago. And a lot of the places that are cold now were tropical forests, like southern Germany and Wyoming. If you go there and you look at the fossils, they were all tropical swamps.
Miami used to be at the bottom of an ocean, for instance.
Right.
But the climate scientists will say, yes, the climate has been changing and will continue to change. It's human activity that has contributed to faster than normal climate change.
And a lot of people make a living saying that, and that's the point that I'm making, that it's gotten to the point where to question that is heresy. And so I don't question that the climate is changing. But as you say, the real question is what role has humans played it? Because the climate has been changing at a time when there were no humans, and ever since. And I think that a real scientific approach has to take that into account.
This skepticism about human factors and climate change from Philip Frost puts him in the same company as Republican Senator Marco Rubio, Florida Republican Governor Rick Scott, and the Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt. A 2014 report from 13 federal government agencies called the U.S. Global Change Research Program begins with this statement, quote, "Many independent lines of evidence demonstrate that the world is warming and that human activity is the primary cause," end quote. Among the consequences highlighted in the report, rising seas. Now, an updated national climate assessment is due next year. This 2014 report called out the South Florida region as especially vulnerable to higher sea levels and storm surges. It is a threat the $305 million Frost Science Museum acknowledges in its own construction. The building is alongside the Bayside in downtown Miami. No exhibitions are on the first floor, and it is designed to withstand storm surges of up to 20 feet. Dr. Frost gave the first $35 million for the museum, a donation that grew by another $10 million after the project ran short of cash. We got on the topic of climate change and the museum during a wide-ranging discussion in a conference room on the 15th floor of his headquarters in Miami. Frost says he wasn't too involved in putting together the current exhibits at the museum, but he plans on playing a bigger role with what visitors experience in the future.
Would you support more climate-based science type of installations and displays?
Yeah, you know, there is a certainly Miami is a hotbed of activity for climate change, and a lot of the original work on the subject was done right here in Miami. And I think what I would like to see is, for those people who are interested, a serious discussion about what it really is all about, because it's like it's become such a big topic in the popular media that it's become almost a religious issue rather than a scientific issue. So I like to bring it back more to a scientific level for serious discussion rather than political debate.
Another area he'd like the museum to explore is the search for extraterrestrial life in the universe. It's a project he's talking about with the Smithsonian and its Astrophysics Observatory. Frost's wife, Patricia, is a former chair of the Smithsonian National Board. He envisions it as a traveling exhibit focused on the search for life beyond Earth.
Some may hear that and think about ET and science at a science museum as a bit off course for a building that's supposed to celebrate empirical evidence.
Yeah, but there's an amazing amount being done now by the sophisticated world of science in that direction, more than most people are aware of. And that's the objective here, to make them aware of the tremendous interest and excitement that is surrounds this area in a very serious way, such that it has never occurred before because the tools haven't been available until recently. We're in the process of building the world's largest observatory that will be going into space, and that should be launched within, it's been 12, 13 years in the construction, and it's a telescope that will be out there in space that's been designed to look back to the Big Bang to see how it all began, and that sort of thing is new.
There's intellectual common ground in Frost's way of thinking about the Science Museum, the search for ET, and his skepticism about human factors and climate change. Call it scientific inquiry.
It's a search, so we're searching for information, for facts, as I would like to do with the question of factors that influence climate as well.
And he has the museum to do it. The Philip and Patricia Frost Museum of Science opened last month after delays due to financing trouble. Frost's total contribution was $45 million, and Miami-Dade County wound up forwarding what was going to be an annual subsidy into a lump sum in order to help finish construction. Instead of giving the museum money each year to defray operating costs, the county money is being used to pay back a loan that was used to finish the building. Taxpayers have the most money invested in the museum, more than $200 million, most of which comes from a property tax bond that's more than a decade old. The museum is counting on more than 700,000 visitors a year to buy tickets.
How confident are you in the ongoing financial sustainability of the Science Museum, knowing that the yearly subsidy that the county had planned on giving will not be there?
I'm feeling much better now about it than I was before the opening, because one could not have anticipated how much interest there would be on the part of the community. And that's what it's all about. This is for them. It's for the community. And if this is of interest to them, and if it's important to them, they will support it. Having said that, it will continue to need support from whether it's from the county or from philanthropy. The people will get what they want if they're willing to help pay for it.
Well, it doesn't feel like it's going to be coming from the county. The county commission has been relatively clear when it was able to forward the yearly maintenance.
I didn't say exactly where it will come from, but there are many possible sources of funding. You know, some institutions that people are more interested in and for that are more important for the people are those that should get better support from whatever. Whether it's the county or the state or individuals, and I think that's what will happen.
And to attract that support, visitors may experience the search for life in the universe and examining the human role in a changing climate, if Frost plays a role in future exhibits at the Science Museum he helped pay for. Still to come, building his third drug company from Miami and the cost of health care.
There are many factors that go into the costs. Pharmaceutical and drug costs are a small part of it. So although a lot of attention is focused on the drug industry, people are probably looking in the wrong place if they're interested in saving a lot of money.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. Phil Frost has been called the Warren Buffett of biotech. It's an apt description of Frost, but with two significant differences. Both Buffett and Frost have built their fortunes by buying and building companies, but Buffett tends to behave more like a financial manager than a big CEO. Frost, on the other hand, buys companies to run them himself. That's the first difference. He's done it 11 times since creating OPCO in 2007 by way of a three-way merger. OPCO has bought drug development companies and medical diagnostic firms. It has 10 strategic investments in a variety of smaller companies involved in a host of drug and medical device research. And that's the second difference, Frost's concentration. While Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway owns Dairy Queen, Geico Insurance, and Benjamin Moore Paints, among dozens of other companies, Frost tends to focus his business investments directly in the health industry, in medicine development especially. It's a concentration that has served him well, putting him on the Forbes list of richest Americans, number 134. He got there through two previous drug companies and changing the pharmaceutical industry along the way. His first, Key Pharmaceuticals, was a Miami company he took over in 1972. At Key, Frost took the company's medicines and figured out new delivery methods, like time-release capsules. 10 years after taking over Key, the company was selling $100 million worth of medicine a year. In 1986, Frost sold Key for more than $800 million. His next company would be even bigger. Ivex was created by merging three companies together as Frost began to look for new drug discoveries to make. Ivex grew quickly through selling generic medicines and then developing its own treatments. Frost sold Ivex in 2005 to an Israeli competitor for more than $7 billion, and he didn't retire. He turned his attention to Opko Health. That's the company he has run for the past decade from the same building in which he ran Ivex.
It's a hybrid of a different sort. It's a combination of the diagnostics side of the industry with therapeutics. On the therapeutic side, our interest is in developing important new drugs that can be used by lots of people. On the diagnostic side, we have a large reference laboratory with over $1 billion in sales. It's headquartered in New Jersey, although we have a laboratory right here in Hialeah.
Opko's medical test labs business is called BioReference Labs, and it's responsible for more than $1 billion in revenue. This combination of businesses running clinical diagnostic labs and therapeutics or medicines is designed to benefit each other.
We have a new drug for chronic kidney disease that's a form of vitamin D. Well, our laboratory does thousands of vitamin D and blood analyses a year. And it goes on and on like that.
You have the therapeutic side, the drug development side, and you have the bioreference side, the testing side. The bioreference side, the testing side, generates the income, generates really the substantial revenue to allow for the experimentation. Why not focus on that testing portion that is generating so much revenue?
We are. And there is one particular part of it that involves a new test. The business that you're referring to is, when all is said and done, a commodity type of business. And as such, it has smaller profit margins and with growth coming more slowly. Whereas with a new drug, the growth is explosive or potentially explosive. So we have, on the other hand, a new diagnostic test, the 4K score test for prostate cancer, which has the potential to generate more profit with a single test than all of BioReference, our diagnostic company with $1 billion in sales, put together.
Among the keys for success in this business, and really in most health industry businesses, is getting insurance companies to pay for a service, drug, or test. For Opko's 4K score test for prostate cancer, that means Medicare. Opko gets paid almost $600 for each test. More than 18,000 of the tests were performed in the first quarter. Now, even though the test has not gotten the final formal approval by the proper Medicare payment processing contractor, Frost says Opko is getting paid for its tests, and he thinks the market for this prostate cancer test is huge.
There are approximately 20 million PSA tests done as a screen for prostate cancer. Of those, approximately 20 or 30% are elevated and therefore require further analysis or attention. Those are the patients that benefit from our 4K test. And if they have the 4K test done, they can avoid what is all too often the next step, which is a biopsy of the prostate. And we have tremendous trials showing that with the use of the 4K score test, you can avoid more than 50% of the biopsies, which is a very big deal, not only for the payers, but more important for the men who can avoid going through a very painful experience with a lot of side effects all too often. So that product is being marketed now through the BioReference, although it lends itself to being exploited more broadly. And we're very shortly going to embark on a direct-to-consumer TV program for the 4K score to take advantage of that huge, huge market.
This is not a new strategy for a drug company within the last several decades, but the idea of marketing medicine and devices directly to consumer has been seen by some as helping drive the cost of healthcare overall.
Right. I think that it's complex because you could make the case that by making people aware of a diagnostic test and getting tested early, you could avoid the more major costs associated with a full-blown disease if it's detected early. On the other hand, there are drugs that are promoted on TV that are very costly, and it's conceivable that they're being promoted that were to replace drugs that are less expensive that might be used. So it's complicated. Each case is different. We hope for us with the 4K score, the more it's used, the more money will be saved for the system, and the better the outcomes will be for the men and the with early detection.
OPCO gets about $600 for each of those tests right now from Medicare. Next year, it's due to get $750. Frost has been in the middle of the health industry for decades, seeing health prices escalate.
Tell us how you do think about this, how you approach this with a long career in medicine and a long career in business about the sustainability, number one, broadly speaking, of healthcare costs, but also the role that for-profit healthcare plays in this discussion and in potential solutions.
There are many factors that go into the costs. As you probably know, pharmaceutical and drug costs are a small part of it, roughly 10% of the overall cost of healthcare. So although a lot of attention is focused on the drug industry, people are probably looking in the wrong place if they're interested in saving a lot of money.
Where should they be looking? Where should regulators and legislators be looking?
They really need to be looking at hospital costs, which represents the major area. And there, again, it's difficult. What we're living through is a time when you have more sophisticated equipment that's being utilized that costs more. Salaries in the industry are higher and higher. When I was young, if you went to a hospital, many of the nurses were religious, were nuns who worked for nothing. And
it's tough to compete with that, isn't it?
It's hard to compete with that, but that's the history of hospitals. And that if you go to the UK, the nurses were called sisters, and still are in many places. And people who worked in hospitals in general were paid very little. Physicians were paid very, very little. When I was an intern, my salary was $1,100 a year, and I had to pay for my food and uniforms out of that. When I was a first-year resident at the University of Pennsylvania, it went up to $2,500 a year, and I had to pay for my not only food and uniforms, but my living quarters. So you can see that the things have changed dramatically, where interns and residents now make living wages. It was always thought that that was a part of your education, and that it was a privilege to have those positions. And that was true of the nurses too. They made very little. And that's a big part of the costs, personnel costs. It's just a different world, and we need to recognize that.
Are there avenues to be explored on a regulatory side, on a legislative side, or even a business practice side that you see are not being exploited in this domestic debate we're having in the United States regarding healthcare costs?
Yeah, I think so. I think so far as the drugs are concerned, the FDA is a great organization with a lot of very wonderful, smart people, but it's become very bureaucratic, like other agencies, other parts of government. And because it deals with such a touchy area, healthcare, you find that individuals and departments in general tend to bend over backwards to be very careful and to err on the side of being too cautious rather than what would be considered more normal. And this overly cautious approach may represent a 2, 3, 5, or 10-fold increase in the cost of developing products compared to a more judicious approach.
But has it led to safer products, though, in the marketplace? The FinFin challenges, the Vioxx challenges, these were medicines that went through that process that wound up getting pulled.
I'm not sure that it has really avoided any of that type of issue, because by and large, those are problems that come arise after long-term, after use in larger populations, which are not required and couldn't be required anyway. It's only after the larger populations have used them for a long time that they show up. It's a different type of statistical analysis. So I think drugs could be approved more quickly. I think even in the manufacturing area, 80% of the requirements have to do with record keeping rather than the manufacturing steps themselves. And many of the plants that get shut down aren't shut down because they find something wrong with the product, but because the records aren't kept as tidy as possible. Now, records are important, and it's one can be you can use more judgment.
It wasn't that long ago we did see some third-party drug manufacturers, over-the-counter drug manufacturers, have problems with manufacturing regarding some very popular allergy medicine and those kinds of things. We've seen compound pharmacies, for instance, get into some pretty significant regulatory binds because of issues around manufacturing.
The problem is that there are always bad actors that show up and they need to be controlled and regulated, no question about it. But that's different from the serious manufacturer and drug company that's there trying to do a good job. You know that it wasn't too long ago when the FDA was established that its mission was to establish safety of drugs. Efficacy was not required. That was not part of it. It thought that the marketplace could take care of that issue. If a drug didn't work, the physicians would stop ordering it. But now, with efficacy being part of it, it's very tricky because very often the criteria used to determine efficacy are somewhat arbitrary, if not even capricious. It's all an attempt to be scientific about it and to be fair about it, to be sure. It's serious. It's not that anyone is trying to do bad things. It's all cloaked in doing good. But it would probably be reasonable to offer a little more leeway so far as the criteria for efficacy are concerned.
Almost all of the healthcare debate that we've had over the past 25 years has been on coverage of healthcare, the payer, the insurance side of things. What do you think the right premise is when thinking about healthcare economics from a legislative standpoint?
It's complex, but there are many things that one could do that the legislators don't want to touch. For example, medical legal considerations.
Tort reform, liability.
Tort reform. They don't want to use the word, especially the Democrats, because they're largely supported by, they have tremendous support from their lawyer groups. And that would be a tremendous benefit right off the bat. All the time and the money that's wasted on the lawsuits. You look at the TV ads that for the strike suit, the lawyers. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be lawsuits, but a tort reform could go a long way toward helping.
those lawyers advertising malpractice would point back to the drug manufacturers to say, well, they can advertise their products to consumers. Why can't we?
Well, I never thought much of advertising for drugs either. Diagnostic tests are different.
Says the CEO of a company with a major medical diagnostic division. Frost is in his early 80s. He's been in medicine for more than 50 years, and he's been running his own healthcare companies from a Miami base for more than 40 years. As we sit in his conference room inside a suite of executive offices, he leans in when talking business. He's excited for an experimental OPCO drug to treat an enlarged prostate, not least of all because of the market potential, 50 million men in the United States alone. That treatment still is in a testing phase. A separate drug already on the market is for certain chronic kidney disease patients. There's the company's long-acting human growth hormone that's under development. There's testing of a medicine to treat a form of epilepsy, and the company's growing genome testing business. The drug and diagnostic development business is one fraught with risk. This is the nature of science and investing, and Frost says they face that risk by doing things their way.
It's a way of not being bureaucratic, to be able to make decisions quickly, to have small groups of highly competent people working together as a team with tremendous commitment and energy and a sense of urgency to get the job done.
What is it that's getting you continuously feeding that drive of yours?
It's the idea of working with a small group creating important big products. To do things a little bit differently, to do things our way, but show that we can have a major impact, both in terms of the utility of the products, but also to benefit and create value for our investors, and to what end? To be able to contribute more to the community, to do good things, to do good works.
A little later in the program, we'll talk with Phil Frost about the millions of dollars of philanthropy he has donated. But up next, we talk building billion-dollar businesses here in South Florida.
There is nothing to discourage one, except for the fact that it is difficult to attract the type of help that you need to develop a sophisticated technology business here in Miami.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Today, we're featuring our conversation with Dr. Philip Frost. When Frost came to Miami, the Dolphins were still a year away from playing their first game of professional football. It was 1965. Since then, Frost has built and sold two pharmaceutical companies and is building his third medical firm now. That company, OPCO Health, is a $3.5 billion company based on Biscayne Boulevard. OPCO followed Ivax, which Frost sold to Israeli drug maker Teva in 2006. That deal made Frost a billionaire. Ivax followed Key Pharmaceuticals. Frost took that company over in the early 1970s and sold it about 15 years later, making him a multimillionaire.
Miami was a small town back in 65, and there was very little in the way of technology in a business sense of any sort. Yet there was a small pharmaceutical company that had been in existence for some time called Key Pharmaceuticals, and in fact it was a public company with good technology, not totally exploited in the best possible way. But in terms of the business climate here in Miami is concerned, I think the main industry here was tourism for sure, and then as a offshoot of that, the real estate business and construction business, which as you know was and always has been very cyclical here.
Some may hear that and say, not much has changed in the intervening 40, 50 years.
No, I believe that's true. But there has been a little bit more development in the technology area. Still small, and that's one of the things that I try to change with our investments in what you're calling philanthropy. I look at them as investments in the future of the area. All that is by way of trying to have the technical side of Miami develop more rapidly and more deeply.
So as you've been at the forefront of that evolution, how do you describe just that general change in climate that you encounter today regionally for business that you also encountered back in the late 60s and early 70s when you had that chance encounter with key pharmaceuticals and were able to take advantage?
The climate, I would say, is very similar. It's a very welcoming community so far as getting encouragement from the local communities and the state, for that matter. There are efforts to try to help groups get started in business, and I'm not sure that they're taking advantage of very much, but there is that effort. But certainly there is nothing to discourage one, except for the fact that it is difficult, there's no getting around it, to attract the type of help that you need to develop a sophisticated technology business here in Miami. This just isn't a center yet where there's a critical mass of people working so that you can, if you need, go out and hire a dozen new people. That's one of the drawbacks here, and that's one of the things we're trying to overcome.
How were you successful in meeting those challenges with your two previous business successes, Key Pharmaceuticals locally in pharmaceutical manufacturing, and then IVEX in the generic space? The manufacturing didn't happen here, but this was headquarters. This was administration. This was finance. This was management and strategy.
Right. And it's as you say, there was some manufacturing here at Key Pharmaceuticals and some at IVEX. But for IVEX, when it became a larger company with sales in the billions, most of the manufacturing was done outside of Miami, and for that matter, the product development as well. And that's also the case with OPCO. Our manufacturing is primarily in Ireland and in Israel at the moment, with almost none being done here. And so far as laboratory development is concerned, again, very little here in Miami, although we have some.
But back to the experience with IVEX and with Key, how did you address the managerial, the administrative personnel challenges that you still have identified today?
It was largely by running a very lean managerial team, so we didn't have a large group, and we used our personal contacts to recruit people who we knew were very good friends and who wanted to work together. And it was largely in that way. I would say that the best people that we recruited to come here came through that route rather than through headhunters or the normal channels.
And are you still utilizing those same kinds of opportunities today for OPCO Health?
We try to, but our needs are a little bit different now. We need more people who are skilled at drug development in terms of regulatory affairs and trial, clinical trial execution, that sort of thing. And not easy to find them. And so we have a subsidiary group working in Toronto, Canada, alongside of the group here, mainly to provide the headcount that we need.
Dr. Philip Frost, chairman and CEO of OPCO Health. The company has about 6,000 employees spread over a dozen locations in six countries. Still to come, giving away his fortune.
In the end, it's relatively easy to write a check, but it's a lot more challenging and demanding to try to formulate a vision and to try to have it executed.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Even if you don't know how he made his money, odds are you have heard his name, Frost. It hangs on South Florida's newest museum building, the Philip and Patricia Frost Museum of Science. It's the name of FIU's Art Museum and the University of Miami's School of Music. A network of research groups at UM will be brought together in the years ahead under the new Frost Institutes for Science and Engineering. That gift represents the largest public pledge, $100 million, for the Frosts. They are among the 169 individuals and couples who have signed the Giving Pledge, a pledge to give away at least half of their wealth to charitable causes during their lives or in their wills. They made the pledge in 2011. We talked with Frost about his vision and motivation behind he and his wife's philanthropy.
Well, first of all, we have a large interest in the Miami community. So a good part of it is directed here. And we're interested in the arts and sciences. It's as simple as that. And we want to try to create more and better activities centered around arts and sciences.
You told Forbes magazine recently, quote, "We want to make Miami more of a technological and science center. When we came here, people thought of Miami as anything but that." What do they think of Miami now with your philanthropic investments in the community?
Well, aside from our investments, I think people think of this as a thriving, dynamic, growing community. And I think they think of it in general terms of a place that people where people want to be and to live and to share in the excitement and enthusiasm of what's happening.
There's tremendous wealth in South Florida, and there's tremendous wealth gap in South Florida. How does your philanthropic effort address that gap, and should philanthropy take that gap into consideration?
Yeah, I think it should. And I think that everything that we do should affect people at the lower end of the spectrum also. As part of the Frost School of Music, we have a program, an outreach program, to go into the schools and to give children who otherwise wouldn't have it the opportunity to learn to play a musical instrument and to get expert teaching. In the case of the Science Museum, there's a whole program, a regular program to not only welcome the students into the school, into the Science Museum on a daily basis, but to go out to the schools with teaching in the hope that it will inspire them and to make them think about more than what they're seeing in their home environment.
You are known as a hands-on philanthropic source. Why that kind of approach as opposed to perhaps more of a board type of approach or something that is a bit more arm's length, I suppose, is the right way to describe it?
Well, you know, we do a certain amount of that as well. Because there are many good causes, and in the end it's relatively easy to write a check, but it's a lot more challenging and demanding to try to formulate a vision and to try to have it executed.
So what do you look in matching that vision with the recipient?
We look at gaps in what's available and try to play a role in filling them.
The ability to create wealth here, as you have, has that given you a certain sense of obligation to the local community when it comes to your philanthropic ideas and efforts?
You know, I can't say that I feel the obligation. I think what we do comes more from within than pressure from outside.
Giving is a learned experience. It's not genetic. That's what Phil Frost told our partner, the Miami Herald, a year ago April, when the Miami-Dade County Board voted to extend a financial lifeline to the Frost Museum of Science. At the time, the museum's fundraising efforts had come up short, and it was running out of money to finish construction. The museum opened a month ago. Still to come, from South Philly to South Florida.
One likes to learn on an ongoing basis, and you can do it by reading, by going to lectures and meeting with other interesting people. But to be right in the middle of a field where you have the opportunity to be at the forefront is thrilling.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. When Phil Frost went before the Miami-Dade County Commission back in April of last year to help secure a change in county financing to save his namesake science museum, he did not talk about his career in science, building three publicly traded pharmaceutical companies from Miami. Instead, he turned back to his time as a young boy in Philadelphia to make his case.
It was 1942 when I was 6 years old, living in Philadelphia. It was at the beginning of the Second World War. And my older brother, who was in the Army, had come back for a day of furlough. He had one day. And what did he decide to do? He decided to take his little brother, me, to the Science Museum in Philadelphia, the Franklin Institute.
Frost said after living in Miami for 51 years, this was the first time he had addressed the county commission during a public meeting.
I can tell you how I was dazzled, inspired, and I can tell you also that having gone back many, many times after that, it actually has had an influence on the decision for me to go into science as a career.
Frost's career in medicine is what initially brought him to South Florida. And even though he became an entrepreneur, CEO, philanthropist, and a member of the Forbes 400 list of richest Americans, Frost still thinks of himself with the title he had when he first arrived in South Florida.
I think of myself primarily as a dermatologist who has broadened my horizons by expanding into other areas of medicine that are of interest to me. And that, in a way, is a follow-up of what I did in dermatology, was to think about what people need to take care of themselves, what they need to have their ailments treated, and what might be available that could do the job better. So I was always interested in new products and in the development and the discovery of new products. So it was natural that I found my way into the pharmaceutical business.
Why do you still today consider yourself first and foremost a dermatologist?
Because that's how I launched my career in science and in medicine. And, you know, the nice thing about medicine is that it can be what you want to make of it. As a practicing physician, you can touch many lives, but a limited number. And I had the good fortune of directing a training program so I could train other dermatologists and expand the number of lives I touched in that way. But that's what I think we're all interested in doing, is having an impact. And by developing new drugs that can be used to treat hundreds, thousands, millions of people, you touch many more in lives. And if you can form a company that could have thousands of employees, it's another way of doing that. And many investors, that's still another way of doing that. And all of that, for me, is a source of pleasure.
And creating the wealth that has led to your philanthropy that has touched certainly the lives.
Hopefully, as you do all of this, you're increasing asset value at every step. And that's good for the community. It's good for the country. It's good for everyone.
What's the source of that drive? What was the seed of that drive for you, the son of a shoe salesman in Philadelphia?
Well, I think the idea, first of all, is to achieve personal security. And once one has a sense of security, it's a question of what one will do in the space of a lifetime, which after all is short, with the assets that you've accumulated. And that leads naturally into the concept of philanthropy. And there again, what you want to do, or in my opinion, what I'd like to do along with Pat, is to do things in such a way that we can be involved personally with a vision that we believe will do the most good for the largest number of people.
Talk to me about growing up in Philadelphia. What were the lessons learned in the community you grew up in the household you grew up in, that you've taken with you today?
I grew up as a little boy in South Philadelphia, living above my family shoe store. By the time I was 12, 13 years old, my father, who was ready to retire, did retire, and we moved to another neighborhood where I continued to have access to business because I had two older brothers. One was a dentist, but the other had a large hardware and building supply business. And on Saturdays and during the summers, I would work there. So I would learn about selling in general, even something about buying, and in general, about the concept of making a profit. And again, the concept of having what people want and need as your commodities.
What still drives you today after such great success that you've experienced and others have experienced? What's fueling that competitive spirit today for you?
No, it's not so much competition at all. It's more the pleasure that I get every day from learning something new. Especially in this particular business, there's so much going on that it's almost impossible to keep up. And the developments are more and more exciting and far-reaching. So that's tremendously interesting. You know, one likes to learn on an ongoing basis, and you can do it by reading, by going to lectures and meeting with other interesting people. But to be right in the middle of a field where you have the opportunity to be at the forefront, not only to absorb but to feed back and develop, is thrilling.
You've been in the middle of that, the center of that in the pharmaceutical and biotech and biopharmaceutical world for the better part of 30 or 40 years. Do you remember the last job you had where you weren't the boss?
I guess that was in the hardware store back in Philadelphia. No, that's not quite right, because in between, I did work at the National Cancer Institute as a clinical associate doing research, and I certainly wasn't the boss there. And then I came to join the faculty at the University of Miami School of Medicine in the Department of Dermatology, and I wasn't the boss there. But after that...
But since then, Dr. Philip Frost has been his own boss. That is the Sunshine Economy for this week. Pilar Ribe is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.